I heard it ID in code, and I caught the 2BS. And, you know, they were under it. They were talking, and the ID came on. They're definitely on the machine, and I think we already opened up for net mode. I can't check now because I lost connectivity to Toronto temporarily. But, yeah, that's it. And, probably skip.
Okay, my only confusion is its frequency is should be far enough away from us not to cause a problem. So is the skip smearing the bandwidth?
I think you guys doubled.
Let me try again. Let me see if I have it. Okay, I was just wondering, it's supposed to be going at 146.835, so why should it interact with us at 146.850, unless their repeater is kind of broken and just spewing out much wider than it should?
KD2FIU, comment?
Yes, George, comment away.
I was when the height of it was happening, I was monitoring 146.250, no signal coming in. So I was not getting that repeater input. I was listening to the output only, and I was getting them. And I was not hearing, I was not seeing a repeater tone on my scan.
Okay. I don't know. The fact that a repeater call sign bled through along with the rest of the noise would make me think that the repeater is involved in some way in probably propagation conditions. So apparently this has passed. Hopefully this will not happen again. Who knows? I looked up NJ2BS, and of all people, Gordon, who used to frequent our net, who had his own technical net in New Jersey, is listed as the guy running that particular repeater. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is still the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, Limark's technical net. So, again, if anyone has any questions of a technical nature, any topics, any comments, what have you, please feel free, hit the push-to-talk button, and tell me your first name and your call sign.
H-U-S-C-P.
Yes, Chris.
Thanks, Roy. Just on that previous subject, maybe Lou is picking up that call sign from the repeater. It might be hitting that repeater on accident. But I have a question for you on antibody testing on COVID.
Okay.
So on the thing, it also says spike semi-quantitative. And the question is, I'm seeing results from different people. Sometimes the result is a number of 25, sometimes it's 100, and then sometimes it's 1,500. And there seems to be no rhyme or reason or on that test and what it actually means. And I'm wondering if you can explain that or you know anything about that?
I would assume that that has to do with the dilutions. Some serology tests, you dilute 1-to-1, you know, 2-to-1, 4-to-1, 8-to-1, 16-to-1, 32-to-1, and such, and you look for a positive result, and it gives you a rough approximation of how strong you have, how large the number of the concentration of antibodies in the blood sample that you took.
Okay, so but the question is, why is it such a wide range of results? I've heard people say, I'm 25 and I'm good, I don't need the booster. And then other people said, I'm 1,500, I don't need the booster. And it doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to those numbers.
Yeah, I think people are kind of drawing the wrong conclusion. Again, it gives you a rough approximation of antibody activity in your blood serum. It does not give you any indication of what your white blood cells in your lymphatic system is doing. We think we mentioned about a year or so ago a bunch of volunteers who volunteered to have a bone marrow aspiration where B and T cell lymphocytes go to do their magic. And it's very important whether or not you have memory white blood cells that are sensitive to the antigen, because that's one of the major ways that we're immune to things. Initially, we build an antibody response, but over time, the antibody concentrations dwindle, because otherwise we'd have very viscous blood if we had all the antibodies to all the infectious processes we came across. So they did a very good study that demonstrated that despite dropping in antibody titers, the amount of T-cell activity was still high. Unfortunately, most people are not going to volunteer for bone marrow aspirations. They are painful, uncomfortable, and most people aren't that generous. So the titers of the antibody is a kind of very loosey-goosey approximation to your immunity, but it's only a small portion of the bigger picture that people aren't aware of. So they're waving titer numbers, I guess.
Gotcha, understood, thank you. And so I'm guessing you really shouldn't use it as to whether you should get a booster. Is that correct?
Correct. Again, because it's more important what's going on in your bone marrow, and no one has a clue. A lot of the studies recently are not based on bone marrow aspirations, unfortunately, because of the problems of getting them from people. They're kind of just backtracking people, finding how many people who are immunized come down with an infection, the degree of the infection. And so it's a statistical analysis, mostly in the Israeli studies, that are the basis of a lot of this boosting sentiment of people. You know, when it first came out, I was kind of iffy about the whole thing. Again, it's topping off your tank. And, you know, in a perfect world with everyone immunized, that's a great idea. I just wish we could somehow magically immunize the third world to at least a mediocre level of 70% before we fill up our tank from 90% to 95%.
Thank you. I appreciate it. What one other comment and question? The videos you posted regarding the way electricity moves. You were exactly right. It did give me a gigantic headache and confused me even more. But I noticed tonight you were talking about Paul's problem and dissimilar metals. You mentioned that the problem with dissimilar metals is an electron can move from one metal to the other, to the electrons or something. That goes against what all those videos are saying, that the electrons don't move. So that confused me even more. You have a comment on that, K2SDP?
Yes, Chris. Electrons move. They don't. Electrons in a direct current move in one direction. In an alternating current, they jiggle back and forth, so they do move. But a minuscule amount. A moving electrical charge induces a magnetic field, which induces an electric field, which induces an electromagnetic field. So there's a bunch of things going on simultaneously. Electrons do flow through a conductor. That's the drift velocity that we talk about that Dick used to love to discuss because, you know, people have this idea you turn a switch, the light lights on immediately, instantly. But, you know, we know that things don't happen instantly, so, okay, they happen at the speed of light. But people get the idea that the electron is traveling from the battery to the light bulb at the speed of light, which it isn't. The drift velocity of actual free electrons is inches per hour. So dissimilar metals have different strengths that hold their electrons, their valence electrons, to them. If you have some atom two metals that have a significant difference, you will have an exchange of electrons. Matter of fact, if you've ever done the old experiment where you stick a piece of copper and a piece of zinc into a lemon and you're able to get a voltage potential between the two, that's exactly what's going on. Through the acid medium, the electronegativity of the copper and the zinc are different enough that electrons will flow through the conductors and ions will flow within the lemon.
So that's a really good analogy with the lemon, and I do remember that experiment. And that's the part that bothers me with this whole electricity flow thing, because it seems like the electrons are flowing through the lemon to get to the other electrode. Boy, that stuff is confusing, I'll tell you. K2SDP.
Well, yeah. Look, the deeper you get, and you saw that amazing YouTube video, and again, everything that he said is correct, but that doesn't negate the fact that it's migraine-inducing. And the jumble in his mind where he rambles on about these things is the least educational. This guy is a professor who teaches electrical engineering students, so I have pity for all of them combined. But going back to the battery, the way that batteries in general and the lemon and the two pieces of metal work is that the ions, the atoms that have their electrons pulled out, travel through the internal medium of the lemon. The electrons travel through the conductor of the dissimilar metals. So the electrons go through the conductor, the ions go through the liquid squishy part pulp of the lemon. It isn't that there's no electron flow going in currents. It's that the current of the electron flow manifests an electromagnetic field that better explains the directionality. If you just take electrons, how does it know that it's supposed to go to the load, the lamp? It's just going in a circle. So why is it stopping there and giving its energy? If you reduce it to the fields of force of the electromagnetic waves, it's going straight from the battery to the load. If you reverse the polarity, it's still going in that same direction. So it's a better way of understanding why electricity flows the way it does, the directionality of it, as well as other aspects. And the fact that if you disrupt the dielectric around the conductor, it causes the conductor to malfunction.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it, Roy. K2SDP.
Okay, very good, Chris. Fascinating subject. I mean, it touches upon a lot of amateur radio aspects. We talk about the difference between a bare metal antenna and an antenna that has an insulating material, and it changes the resonance slightly, and it does that because dielectric constant of air is different than the dielectric constant of most insulators that we cover our wire antennas with. So it goes back to coaxial cables, that coaxial cables have a lower than a speed of light velocity. That's because the material, the electromagnetic waves going through the dielectric of the foam insulator slows down, or apparently slows down, because electromagnetic waves always travel at the speed of light. The perceived phase velocity changes due to the dielectric. Nevertheless, always fun to talk about these things. I hope I didn't give anyone a terrible headache. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you the links, and then we'll move on to SpaceNet Report.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right, let me just understand something. So, at DC, direct current is still generating electromagnetic field?
Well, that's when things start to go a little flaky. The way it was presented in the Veritasium, they were actually pretty much talking about the instantaneous state. There's two types of states. There's instantaneous and there's steady state. For steady state, things settle down. You're not changing the electric field, so you're not inducing an electromagnetic field. It would be interesting if someone comments upon the steady state condition, because the way it was presented was the instantaneous state. With alternating currents, you don't have that problem because there's never a steady state because it's perpetually changing.
So, at say, does this conductor radiate the electromagnetic field, or is it contained? And is this such a concept to be applied here as radiation resistance, as we do on our antennas?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's contained in the near field for the most part, and there is loss due to the inherent resistance of the conductor that's being used as a means of producing the electromagnetic waves. Radiation loss, radiation resistance, is a term where the energy is dissipated in the actual emission of RF. Now, at high frequencies, you know that you got to keep your length of wire very short because little pieces of wire can act as inductors, capacitors, and antennas. So for all intents and purposes, I think the amount of energy lost in a dissipation of an electromagnetic wave that wasn't closed in on itself would be very, very small in the situation that Veritasium set up.
All righty, NY2H back to net. You give the links and we'll listen for a pull. Thank you very much. NY2H clear.
Okay, very good. Again, if you would like to contact me to propose a mailbag question or offer a puzzle or a topic for discussion, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to poke Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at something, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My link page, and I really suggest that you look at some of these things. Again, if you tend to get migraines, you may want to move and not do the one where the professor rambles on for an hour. Nevertheless, I leave it to you. Link page is roy.ac2gs.com. And again, if you are interested in listening to the repeater when you're not within radio distance and you have internet access, you just have to type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you a nice audio feed. And as always, I'd like to remind people of Mike KC2NJI's wonderful archive of past technical nets going as far back as September of 2006. His site, of course, is amateurradio.tv. So thanks again for everyone participating. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned a couple of things. We'll do it again next week. So without any further ado, here is Paul, WS2N, with SpaceNet Report.
AC2GS, WS2N, and thank you, Roy. And we lost a lot of time, so if anybody has any technical questions, you can just either interrupt me, and Roy's always listening, or we could always go longer and do an extended technical net. We have time after 11 o'clock. Like Roy said, we lost, 45 minutes or so. Well, that's the way it goes. There is an important launch that I've been talking about for months now, or actually years, and that's the James Webb Space Telescope,
And that's supposed to be going up, or it was originally, well, as of last night, it was going up on the 18th of December. But now that has been delayed 4 days. The reason the delay is because they're attaching the 40-foot-tall in the position it is now to an adapter, and the adapter then attaches to the top of the Ariane 5 rocket. This is all taking place in South America, in French Guiana, Kourou Launch Complex, and the idea for the next month is to attach this and eventually roll the Ariane 5 out to the launch complex, to the launch where it will take off. To do that, this all has to be done step by step. This is a $10.5 billion project that's taken 20 years, so they're trying to be real careful. So one way they attach to this adapter is using these clamps, and you know they have it's got a strain on it when you attach these clamps, the series of clamps that secure the telescope to the adapter. Well, one of the clamps as they attached it came loose suddenly, and it's got a lot of strain on it, and it created tremendous vibration throughout the James Webb Space Telescope. So it was an uh-oh moment, and they decided to give the crews 4 extra days to check everything out and make sure there's no damage. It was a sudden vibration that actually went through the whole telescope, make sure nothing was damaged. So they ran some checks and tested everything that they could possibly test, and they feel confident. So now they have a new time for well, it's on a Wednesday now. It was going to be on a Saturday, but it's now Wednesday at 22nd. Yeah, the 22nd. At 7:20 a.m. in the morning, Eastern Standard Time. So I'll definitely be looking for that. Anybody that's not working, retired, 7:20 in the morning, and you bring up on the NASA site, they'll be transmitting it. And Ariane 5, the European Space Agency, for that rocket, that you could always find on the web. You put in European Space Agency launch of whatever is going up at the time, and you could see their launches live. And in fact, you hear them do the countdown in French. You know, but there's always somebody speaking English giving a play-by-play of what's going on. So anyway, if that thing makes it into orbit, it's going to be one time around the globe, and it's just going to keep on going. You know, not a full orbit, and then off it goes to the L2 position. 4 times the distance of the moon, and that will take about a month to get there, and then about another 4 or 5 months for calibration of all the equipment that's on board. There are 4 instruments that are ready to go. So I know I've talked about this from week to week, so I won't talk about it again until maybe after, you know, probably next week. But if there's no delays, so that's the new time to look for. It's only a 4-day delay, December 22nd, 7:20 a.m. Let me drop it, see if anybody has any comments. This is WS2M. Well, hopefully that gets off the ground okay. We'll see. The company that's responsible for this attachment system is this company, they come out of Switzerland, RUAG Space. Now, they've been around, you know, for maybe 20 years as this company. But it's a company that really deals with
enclosures of satellites on top of rockets, and they handle the fairings, these massive fairings. They do work for NASA, European Space Agency. They've done work for SpaceX, and they have this whole setup for enclosing the satellite. They also have the system for attaching the satellite to the rockets. They were involved in that, and unfortunately, it was their mistake. So I'm sure they're very happy that no damage had occurred to this. They've been trying to be so careful with this launch, because about three launches ago on an Ariane 5 European Space Agency rocket, when those fairings separated, they're like big clamshells, when they separated, it caused a vibration to one of the satellites. I mean, the satellite that we're launching made it to orbit, no problem. But they didn't like that vibration that was set down by telemetry. So since then, they've been trying to make sure that doesn't happen again, and they took measures to make sure they don't get that vibration. And since that happened, there were two other launches, and they all went very, very good. There was no detection of this vibration. So NASA was happy, and when that occurred, NASA went ahead with, approving the shipment of James Webb Space Telescope from California to French Guiana. They had to go through the Panama Canal to do this. And all was going well. I mean, that was the only screw-up. It was almost a big one. I mean, you could imagine if it did cause some kind of damage. They would have to, either fix it on the spot or maybe send the whole thing back and have it all reworked again. If there was any serious damage, it could have been a major, major problem. But it's been averted. Any comments? I thought I heard somebody key up. I don't know if it was our friend from New Jersey. Oh, I certainly hope not. Anyway, the DART mission is underway. That's the one that's been on the news, I don't know, every day since the thing launched. The news is fascinated with the double asteroid redirection test, or DART mission. That's now on the way to intersect with an asteroid in September. So it'll take a while to get there. But it launched successfully out of California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, on a Falcon 9 rocket, a SpaceX rocket. The booster was recovered successfully on a drone ship out in the Pacific Ocean. And the payload, which is the DART, is now on the way to intersect with by asteroid system. One asteroid is like a half a mile in diameter, and the smaller one is like a moon that goes around it all the time, and it's about 500 feet in diameter. And they intend on smashing this thing into that moon, the smaller moon. And what that will do, it will change the orbital time that thing spends going around the bigger asteroid. And it's going to change its perigee and apogee a little bit as well. And that location where the gravity is normally strongest will change by about 73 seconds. So by doing that, it will eventually move the other asteroid one way or the other. And over time, with ground telescopes, they'll be able to examine to see if this really did work. This will all happen in September. Now, on board DART, there is a smaller smaller satellite that's been attached. Actually, it was built in Italy, and essentially it's a camera. So about 10 days before this thing hits the asteroid, this thing will be released from DART, and it will drift off on an angle, not directly behind it, so that when DART smashes into the asteroid, this thing will be offset a little bit and we'll be able to take pictures, actual video pictures as well. And then over time, it will download that to the Deep Space Network, and they'll be able to actually have a video of this thing crashing into the asteroid, which should be pretty cool. It's going to be hitting at 15,000 miles per hour. So that's going to be great footage once that gets completed. And then there's another mission called Hera that will be eventually going up about a year and a half after the collision. And that's going to be launched by the European Space Agency. And that's another, it's got cameras and instruments, and that's going to get a close-up view of what went on as well. You know, the aftermath of the impact. So between photographs from the Italian spacecraft that's attached to DART, and Hera being set up by the European Space Agency, and then the ground-based telescope eventually making a determination on whether or not this thing worked or not, it should be pretty interesting. Another system that they have on board DART is the power system and the ion rocket that they are using. The new ion rocket, they call it NEXT. Anyway, next is the stands for the NASA Evolutionary Xeon Thruster, and it's next C. And the C stands for commercial. The next C is a new ion engine that is attached to this particular spacecraft, and it's evolved from other ion engines that they've used. Two of the ion engines that they used in the past went on other spacecraft. One was on the first ion spacecraft that European Space Agency used that they tried out back in 2009 or so, even early, I think 2003, correction. That was Deep Space One. That went in orbit around the moon, and eventually they crashed into the moon on purpose. And that was an ion engine. And then the Dawn space station had a similar engine attached to it, and that was the one that flew out to two different asteroids, two biggest asteroids that we know of. One is called Vista, and the other one is Cirrus. Vista, it went into orbit around it. Spent like a year and a half in orbit, and then because of the ion engine, it was able to exit that orbit and go into orbit around Cirrus. And that, you know, was the first time any spacecraft actually went into an orbit around one body and then left and went into orbit around another one. And all done with the ion engine that could fire for, you know, not only days but weeks or even months at a time without shutting it off. All fueled by xenon gas. You know, you take most of the spacecraft that go up, if they say it's a one-ton spacecraft, if it's got, you know, a chemical system, you can bet that half of it, you know, 1,000 pounds is fuel. If it's a, you know, 8,000 pound spacecraft going to geosynchronous orbit, you can guarantee it's probably got about 4,000 pounds of fuel. It's a, you know, 2-to-1 ratio. But with these things, it's not. It's like, you know, with a smart, smart one that European Space Agency launched, it was like 1 to 10 or 10 to 1 ratio. you don't need that much fuel to, you know, relatively big difference. They use xenon fuel. The system ionizes the gas. They use big photocells, you know, that pick up the light, convert it to electricity, and they in a smart one, they convert about 1,000 watts, and they pump that into the ion engine. So basically, you just need a fuel. You don't need a propeller. You know, most spacecraft have a fuel, you know, a hydrazine or something, and then a propeller, like liquid oxygen, or you know, or some kind of combination of the two. With the hydrazine, you would have a nitrogen tetroxide for a propeller. Here, you don't need a propeller. It's free. It's from the sun. It creates electricity. Electricity essentially is a propellant for the xenon fuel. So you can have a very light spacecraft, and you could do marvelous things. I mean, the thrust isn't much. You know, it feels like maybe less than a piece of cardboard sitting on your hand when these engines are firing. But over time, you know, the exhaust gas is going out at like 90,000 miles per hour. I mean, theoretically, you could get up to that speed if you left it on long enough. So that's the story with that. And now, this new ion engine, it's a Hall ion engine that DART is using, has the equivalent of three times the amount of thrust than the older systems that are used on, for instance, the Dawn, or even some of these ion engines that are in geosynchronous orbit that we've been using on a regular basis now. So, you know, it's really an experimental flight. I mean, they want to see if this thing's going to work. I think they know it's going to work. They've had like 45,000 hours of straight operation on using these engines on Earth, you know, for tests. This is the first one that's going up. Again, three times more powerful, which means it's going to get to its location quicker. And in this case, the intended speed will be about 15,000 miles an hour when it hits the asteroid. Any questions or comments? Okay, nothing hard. One other flight that's going to be very interesting coming up next month, I believe, will be a suborbital flight by Blue Origin. Blue Origin has the New Shepard that they've launched a couple of times already. And that's the same one that they launched Jeff Bezos in, the owner of Blue Origin. And same, you know, another flight that they had after that, well, actually the flight right after was unmanned. But then they had another flight with William Shatner on board. And now they're going to have another one. And this one's going to have the daughter of Alan Shepard. Alan Shepard has a daughter, Laura Shepard. And he plans to take a ride on this, which should be interesting. You know, it's named, the rocket is named after Alan Shepard. It's called the New Shepard. And it will be launching the daughter. And she's going to be going on a suborbital flight, similar to Alan Shepard's first flight, which was also suborbital. First American in space. He went up on the Mercury Redstone rocket. You know, I wonder if time goes on, if she's going to, you know, if it becomes commonplace to go to the moon, if she'll be able to also duplicate his second flight, which was on Apollo 14, when he actually walked on the moon. I'm sure a lot of you have seen the clip of an astronaut golfing on the moon. Well, of course, that was Alan Shepard. He was a big golf fan, and he the one that knocked the ball into probably into orbit. On the Apollo 14 mission. And so it looks like there's going to be six people going on this flight, where the previous two flights that were manned were four people. So I'm not sure if that's true. I saw a quick report that it might be six people. One of the other people is a popular personality as well. And he'll be going up. Is Michael Stryton. He's Good Morning America, and then he's done a lot of game shows and that type of thing. So he'll be going up, which is going to be good for tall people. Turns out he's 6'5", so that's higher than the limit that NASA always had a limit on the height. But as time went on, they did away with that limit pretty much. Russia didn't. He wouldn't be able to be allowed to go on a Soyuz spacecraft. They won't allow a 6'5" person to do that. So I thought that was that'll be good. Anything to promote the space tourism is going to help, because that's going to be a big part of the space industry in the future. Space tourism, you're going to have a lot of people willing to pay large sums of money to go on these rockets. There's another one going up in February, and that will be launched on a Falcon 9 SpaceX rocket. That's going to the International Space Station. It's got one retired NASA astronaut that will be flying it. And then three other paying customers. And they made a deal with this company, Axion. Axion is going to be the company that plans on sending up modules, living modules, and attach it to the front of the International Space Station in the years to come. I'd like to see that actually happen, but plenty of people are investing in this company. So maybe they will. But Axion will send these four people up. They're paying SpaceX to do that on a SpaceX Dragon. They'll dock with the International Space Station attached to the Harmony module. And they'll spend about 10 to 12 days on the space station and then return. The idea of Axion doing this is that they're eventually going to have their own modules. And then, with their own bathroom and sleeping quarters and everything, and they'll be able to send up their own people as tourists and actually stay on the space station longer than the present 10 or 12 day that NASA is allowing. After that, they're gone. So, interesting times coming up. That will all be, that flight is going to be February, so. A lot of things are going to be happening in 2022, hopefully. Any other comments? WS2N. Okay, now Russia has been doing pretty good with the space station lately. I mean, they're rolling the dice with some of the equipment that they're sending up, like flipping the whole space station upside down, one and a half turns, like flipping a 30-story building, one and a half turns. That's what they did when they sent the new Iker module, which is a very large module that they attached to the space station a couple of months ago, and that was on where the thrusters were firing, and it was actually trying to back away from the space station. They shouldn't have been firing when they were. They had attached to the space station, and a day later, the thrusters started going off. And they were able to compensate use another spacecraft, a progress spacecraft, to, you know, counteract the force of the thrusters that were firing. Eventually, they think the fuel ran out of it, and that's why it finally stopped. Anyway, they straightened that mess out, and now they have another module that they just attached last week to the Nyoka module. This one is called Prey Hill. The Prey Hill docking module. Essentially, it's got six docking ports attached to it. So they attach one to the big Nyoka module, and then that gives them, you know, five other ports to work with. And the other one, they'll probably just use the one. The other one's probably, I don't think they'll ever use them, but, you know, they're there. They have plans on eventually attaching other modules, but there's nothing ready. But at least they can use this Prey Hill module for docking future manned spacecraft or unmanned spacecraft to it. And then they also have other doors that they could open up. They could also use it for doing EVAs if they had to. Although they do have another one that they've been using for that purpose. So, for instance, after the Nyoka module was docked, days later, eventually, two cosmonauts did an EVA and went out and attached power lines and data lines, you know, TV cameras, antennas to the module, Nyoka module. And now again, after Prail is now attached, they will do another EVA to do similar work, you know, go out, blow along past the, on top of the Nyoka module, and then grab a whole cables and other data lines and attach it to the new docking module. Yeah, they'll have to relocate antennas and things. They need the KERS docking system for future vehicles to dock with it. All that has to be hooked up. They'll do an EVA to do that. And I believe they're going to use European Space Agency astronaut to help one of the cosmonauts. That means they'll be using the Russian spacesuits to do that work. So that should be interesting for the guy from the European Space Agency to get involved with that. Any comments or questions?
K2STP.
K2STP. Hi, Chris. Have you been listening all along?
Of course. Quick question about the James Webb. I'm wondering why they're sending it so far out. I know the farther you get out away from the atmosphere, the cleaner the view is, but it seems like they're way, way out there beyond where anything would be that would bother its vision. So what's the real purpose of going so far out?
Yeah, well, it's an infrared telescope, first of all. So the idea is to keep it as cold as possible. And to actually try to keep it that cold 24 hours a day. So if they were in orbit around the Earth, roughly every 30 minutes, even so, you would have like a 90-minute orbit. Every 30 minutes, you roughly would be, you know, and looking at the sun, and it would be almost, you know, impossible to keep this thing that cold for a long period of time. So, look at the Hubble, and that's what happens with the Hubble as well. Not in darkness all the time. But by going out there, you're going to you're going to bring the temperatures down to, I think the lowest temperature is going to be 7 degrees Kelvin. You're not going to be able to achieve that in Earth orbit. And, you know, I mean, yeah, you could send it to your synchronous orbit, but you're in the same situation. You know, you're still going to be seeing the sun every now and then, no matter what you do. But out there, you don't. You get out to that location, and the reason they they go that far, you know, that is because they don't have to use any fuel to keep it there. You know, once you get out to L2, you know, they call it a halo orbit. It just kind of meanders around out there. It's a perfect gravitational balance between us and the sun. Yeah, the sun, Earth, and that location 1 million miles out. The Earth will keep going around the sun once a year, and this thing will keep going around the sun once a year, and it'll, you know, be located all the time 1 million miles from Earth. You don't have to use any fuel. I mean, they might have to, you know, turn their thrusters on once in a while to, you know, if it starts to drift away, you know, too far. But very little fuel. And then the temperature deal. Because it's infrared, any kind of heat is going to throw off the detection ability. I mean, it would do a good job if it had a little heat behind it, but it's going to be a great job if there's no heat. The lower the temperature, the better. So that's why I have this big sun shield, as big as a tennis court. You have this sun shield that's made up of mylar sheets. There's 5 layers of them, and they're not touching one another. They're just one above the other, and it's as big as a tennis court. And on that one side, you have this big 21-foot gold. They use gold, by the way. Gold is great for infrared. This gigantic mirror that'll be facing out, you know, away from Earth all the time. And so, you know, one part of the year, it'll be facing, you know, toward, the Gemini constellation. And as it goes around, it'll be facing toward, you know, Orion. And, you know, half a year later, it'll be facing the other part of the universe. So they'll be able to always be able to use this thing 24 hours a day. And yet on the cold side, on the cold side you have the telescope, and then on the hot side you have antennas facing, you know, pointing toward Earth to be picked up by the deep space network, or you have your solar panels that are going to be picking up the sun's rays. You also have this deflector piece that's sticking out that as the solar wind hits it, depending how they have this thing pointing, it will be able to change the attitude one way or another. Again, by doing that, they will save on having fuel. So it's really a economics, and primarily because they need to have super low temperatures. And you would think with the super low temperatures, they're going to get down to like plus 7 degrees Kelvin, you know, 7 degrees above absolute zero. They want to get it even a little bit lower. There's actually a refrigeration type of system to actually do that. To even make one of the detectors even lower. So that's the deal. Back to you, Chris. K2 SCP WS2F.
Gotcha. Thanks, Paul. That makes sense. I forgot about the heat issue. Boy, just reading about it a couple of days ago. I was looking at it. I'm really excited, as everyone is. I'm sure you are, to get this thing up there. But boy, is that scary. I mean, it's so risky because if anything goes wrong, we can't get to the thing to fix it. At least not right now. But man, fingers crossed. I hope it all goes well. Thanks, Paul. K2SCP.
Yeah, the thing has to unfold. I mean, the first thing it's gonna move in. This thing's all cramped up inside the fairings of the 17-foot diameter fairing on top of the spacecraft. So once they're gone, and the spacecraft is on its own after it separates from the second stage of the Ariane 5 rocket, now it's on its own. Solar panel will, it's got motors on it, it's going to rotate it out. You've got all kinds of motors to do the next step, which will be to start moving these Mylar things that are all folded up. You have cables that have to be cut, and the way they cut them is with little pyrotechnic bolts that fire and those things will allow these things either spring loaded or with motors. I think there's 84 different mechanisms that have to work. I think they said 84 correctly to move the solar panel, move the antenna into position. You have an antenna, a parabolic antenna that's going to be looking at Earth. You have the sun shield that's going to have to start pulling out. They've got these booms that are going to be stretching out, and as they stretch out, they're going to be stretching these Mylar sheets all the way into this large open position as big as a tennis court. And then now on top of that, the telescope itself, being 21 feet in diameter, it doesn't fit in a 17-foot diameter fairing on top of a spacecraft. They had these mirrors, instead of one big mirror, like the Hubble was, that was just one big 8-foot diameter mirror. This 21-foot thing, it comes in 18 sections, 18 mirrors, and, each one is got a hexagon shape to it, and they're mounted on this beryllium frame, which is very strong material built, and beryllium does not have much of a heat. When you heat it, it doesn't expand or contract at all. It's nothing like steel or aluminum. I mean, it's like the best material ever. And they have little motors and adjustments on it, and when this thing starts to open up, all these mirrors are going to start to realign and realign themselves perfectly. Apparently, they have some kind of a dot or a laser light in that
time completely
to adjust these mirrors. When the light is on, it gives them a pinpoint, and then all the computers and everything are going to control the actuators that move each individual mirror. And on top of that, some of these mirrors are like there's six of them that are completely folded backwards. That have to be completely opened up with the mechanism to do that. I guess motors to bring from the folded back position to the open position. And then, in the long run, you're constructing a 21-foot mirror out of 18 mirrors without people on board. It's all done robotically, automatically, autonomously. I mean, it's going to be some. I mean, if this thing's successful, they always said Hubble was the best. Engineering wise, mechanical wise, this thing will be the best. And of course, the science that they plan on getting off, but it's supposed to be, 100 times better than Hubble. So we'll see how it goes. Any other questions? Okay, not much more. You know, Artemis